Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
We welcome you again to the Mormon Channel and our program, Past Impressions. I'm Brent Topp, Chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine, your host. And in this program, we chronologically go through the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and look at important events, great people, significant issues associated with the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We're grateful for all of our guests and scholars that come in and share with us their great knowledge of the history of the Church. And again, I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Alex Baugh, Professor of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University and one of the Church's experts on the Missouri period of Church history. So, Alex, thanks again for being our guest and sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you, Brent. I really enjoy being with you and talking about these important events in Missouri.
Well, in one of our last episodes, we talked about the Missouri Mormon War, and we talked what we might call the surrender, which ultimately became the arrest of Joseph and many of the leading elders of the church. Why don't we go back to that event? And today we're going to talk about Liberty Jail, but let's talk about how Joseph gets to Liberty Jail.
Yeah, I think that's important. So just to kind of regroup a little bit, on October 31st, Joseph Smith is arrested. And the Missouri militia authorities decided they were going to go after the chief leading elders and try to find some way they can, incriminate them for their activities. So they go after Joseph Smith, Sidney Rigdon, and Hiram Smith. Hiram's actually arrested the next day. So there they get the first presidency. And then they arrest Parley P. Pratt, Lyman White, and George W. Robison and Amasa Lyman. So they're those are the first seven men they actually say, let's get them and incarcerate them. The decision was made, as we talked earlier. Lucas wanted to hold a court-martial and execute them. That was not carried out because of Doniphan. And so Lucas decided that the best thing he could do was to take the Mormon prisoners down to Independence, where he's from, and hold them down there until he knew what they were supposed to do with the prisoners. So on November 2nd, Brent, Lucas brings the prisoners, Joseph, these seven men, into Far West and gives them just a few minutes to go home, to go to their homes. They're all under guard and get some of their belongings and possessions. And I think it's interesting, you know, Section 122 of the Doctrine and Covenants, verse 6, Joseph mentions, "And if thy son, who's only 6 years of age, shall cling to thy garment and shall say, my father, what are these men doing?" That's harking back. That's Joseph mm-hmm. thinking back about when he had a few minutes to go home and say goodbye to Emma and the kids. And that's that incident. So anyway, they bring him to the public square, and this is where they're put into a wagon, and a man by the name of Moses Wilson was put in charge of the prisoners, and they're taken now down to Independence. There's seven of them, only seven at this point,
which is the county's the Jackson County seat.
Yeah. And Lucas is from there. He just doesn't know what to do with them because he can't get them in terms of military law. So he takes them down there. It took him a couple of days to get down there. But I think what's interesting is they were down about 2 days, and they were on the banks of the Missouri River to cross over. And Parley P. Pratt recorded this. He says, this is November 3rd. "As we arose and commenced our march on the morning of the 3rd of November, Joseph Smith spoke to me and the other prisoners in a low but cheerful, confidential tone. Said he, 'Be of good cheer, brethren. The word of the Lord came to me last night that our lives should be given us, and that whatever we may suffer during this captivity, not one of our lives should be taken.'" Hmm. Now, that has to reassure him. Joseph knows they're going to get out of this. Mm-hmm. I think what surprised Joseph in hindsight, was how long it's going to be.
Yeah.
I think he thought, well, things will clear up in a couple of weeks. We'll be home. Mm-hmm. Boy, little he know, it's going to be, you know, five months.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, they make their way to Independence. Joseph writes a letter to Emma as soon as they arrive. We have 11 letters from Joseph Smith during this incarceration. It's amazing they've survived. But he writes this November 4th letter, and he says they're treating us pretty good. It's rainy, it's cold, it's wet. They're in this hotel being fed, but he says it's okay. They treated him fairly nicely. They were there for from November 4th to November 8th. In the meantime, this Lucas gets the word that they are to take the prisoners over to Richmond, and there they're going to have a civilian hearing. Mm-hmm. So they're transported over there, and they arrive there on the 9th of November, Brent. And here is when a man by the name of Sterling Price is placed in charge of the guard, in charge of these men. And they're put in a vacant house. There's a jail being built, but it's not done. So they put him in this vacant house. And this is when Joseph writes him and says, boy, this is brutal. They've got him chained. They're chained to each other. And Sterling Price and his men are tough boys. Mm-hmm. And we all know the story. Every Latter-day Saint ought to be familiar.
Parley's account,
when he says it was one of those tedious nights in Richmond where they were having this preliminary hearing, which we'll talk about. But he mentioned, these guys were pretty—
The foul language, the discussing the terrible deeds that they had done, yeah.
And Joseph rebukes him. So it's a marvelous account of courage. And Parley says, I was so impressed by this. Joseph Smith.
He says, I have seen majesty on but once.
Yeah. In a dungeon, in midnight, in an obscure village town of Missouri. So anyway, they're here. And during this time, Brent, they're going to undergo a preliminary hearing. This is not a final hearing. Mm-hmm. And eventually, if you can believe it, 64 Mormon men were rounded up total, including Joseph, and they held this hearing in this courthouse, this brick courthouse in Richmond, and the judge was a man by the name of Austin King. He goes on to great fame. He becomes the governor of Missouri. He becomes a U.S. congressman, but during the 2 weeks that they're in this hearing, 2+ weeks, they're going to try to find probable cause to see if they can't get Joseph Smith locked up.
And, at the least.
So it's a preliminary hearing just to kind of see that is there some cause that we can actually accuse Joseph Smith of that we can possibly indict him.
Well, what happens in the hearing? What becomes the result of the hearing? And what, if any, charges are levied against him?
Well, the state tries to find state witnesses to testify against Joseph Smith. And they bring in some heavyweights. They brought in Hinkle. They brought in Samson Avart, a Danite leader, and all these men that were associated at one time with Joseph Smith. They're trying to see if he could be held accountable for something. In the end, Judge King said, okay, something happened up in Davies County, and Joseph Smith was obviously up there. So the final decision of King was to hold Joseph Smith in jail on the charge of overt acts of treason in Davies County. So that was the charge. Sidney Rigdon was charged with the same, only overt acts of treason in Caldwell County, perhaps from his statement of
the salt,
salt sermon there, mm-hmm. Or the July 4th sermon.
Oh, yeah.
So eventually he's going to release, King releases all of the other men. He does place five in the jail in Richmond. That's Parley P. Pratt, Morris Phelps, Lumen Gibbs, Norman Shearer, and a guy by the name of Gee, I believe it was, in Richmond for the problems associated with Crooked River. And then he charges six men to be held on these charges, but they don't have a prison in Richmond. So he says, we got to send you over to Liberty. So on December 1st, six men then are placed in Liberty Jail, including Joseph Smith, Sidney Rigdon, and Hiram, the first presidency, and then Alexander McRae, Lyman White, and Caleb Baldwin. So those are the six men that King believes we need to hold accountable to these wrongs that were perpetrated in Daviess County. What I think is probably interesting to our hearers is it looks like, but this point, a kind of a deal has been struck, I guess you might say, and all King is going to do is hold them until the Mormons make their way out of the state, and once they do that, they're going to arrange for Joseph Smith to be released because they really haven't got anything on him. And if you're going to go after Joseph Smith, you got to go after every Missourian that committed acts of violence against the Mormons. So I think, as one Mormon historian, Gordon Madsen, said, it's kind of a King's quest for hostages. We'll just hold them. And once they agree to carry out their part of the bargain, which is leave the state, then we'll try to make it look good, but we'll let them go.
But the saints weren't aware of
that point
arrangement.
In time, no, they're at the time going, gosh, are we ever going to see these guys again? Mm-hmm. You know, so anyway, they come to Liberty Jail, and this is a very, very secure jail. You've been there, Brent. Mm-hmm. This was built in 1833. And by the way, King orders the trial. For the latter part of March. So Joseph now knows, unfortunately, he's going to be stuck there the entire winter. He knows he's just going to have to play this one out. Too bad he couldn't have been stuck there June through August. But in the winter, it was terrible situation.
You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. We're talking with Alex Baugh, and we're talking about the Prophet Joseph Smith's incarceration in Liberty Jail. Alex, why don't we keep talking about the conditions of the Liberty Jail and what was it like? We talked about the security, that it was cold. What were the conditions like under which Joseph and the brethren were suffering there?
It's a pretty tough place to be. First of all, there's no form of heating. And they did, of course, talk about how they tried to occasionally try to get warm by lighting a fire, but there was no place for the smoke. So they just basically smoke them out. They do have some side windows. They tried to block those off with blankets to try to keep some of the cold out. Joseph's always complaining of being cold. I mean, it's just dark. It's damp. It's just not, you know, there's no insulation. I mean, you know what cold stone's like. It just doesn't, or cold cement. It just doesn't warm up. Their biggest complaint, however, is food. And they're probably not fed the best, but I believe McRae and others said they were actually poisoned. I'm not sure about that. They were probably just given food that was bad and caused vomiting and sickness. Years later, the jailer was said that the statement was said that they were fed human flesh at one time from an old slave that died or was killed or whatever. And the jailer years later said, no, well, that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little skeptical at some of the reports that sometimes come through. But, Brand, it was not a good place. I mean, there's no shower facility, bathing facility. Joel's, you can imagine what they looked like after weeks and weeks in this condition.
I think that's an interesting thing because I think as Latter-day Saints, we tend to what I call sanitize certain events in the scriptures and in church history by our artwork. Yeah. And it's inspiring and wonderful, that beautiful painting that we've all come to love of Joseph sitting in Liberty Jail and penning the words that we have in the Doctrine and Covenants, but he probably didn't look like that. And he probably wasn't clean shaven most of the time. In fact,
Dimmick Huntington saw him the day he crossed the Mississippi River
to Quincy
and said, not shaven for some time. I mean, he was pretty rustic looking. So, there's just the conditions were not good. Now, I should say, I think some Latter-day Saints need to understand they got out from time to time.
Yeah, and I think is news to a lot of people is that they why would they be allowed to get out?
They occasionally, of course, would take them out for exercise under a guard. They would go visit their attorneys, Wood and Atchison and Burnett down the road. In fact, Wood said one time Joseph came down and said, I need something to read. And he gave him a book on law. And he says, you know, after he was released, he never gave me that book back. They took him on occasion to a tavern for food, get some genuine, decent food, I guess. So they were always under guard, but they got out. I think there's this misconception they couldn't even stand up.
Yeah.
That's probably not true. Andrew Jensen, our assistant church historian, went to the remains of the jail in the 1880s and measured it. He said it was 6.5 feet on the bottom and 7 feet on top from floor to ceiling. McRae was reported to be 6'6", so he may have had to, scrape his head a little bit if he stood up straight, but they could stand up. And they weren't down in there the whole time. I mean, they had their meals upstairs, so probably during the day they were in the main upstairs area. At night, they'd shove them down in the dungeon, so.
But not to minimize the absolute dismal conditions that they were in. You mentioned Andrew Jensen, and I love the statement of Andrew Jensen there where he talked about that visit in the 1880s where he said that he couldn't stand it 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And how would the prophet be able to stand for over 5 months there? Were they allowed to have visitors? And what do we know about the time? How did they occupy their time when they were in the jail?
They had visitors all the time. In fact, until the Saints left in February, Brent, they had visitors constantly. We know Emma came on several occasions. She spent the night of December 8th and 9th there, spent time with her, with Joseph. She came again later that month for 3 days. Mary Fielding came down in January and showed Hiram her new little baby, Joseph F. Smith. There's good evidence on that occasion, Hiram blessed Joseph F., by the way. So they're having visitors. They're bringing food. They're corresponding, so on and so forth. But after February, when most saints have left, then it becomes really lonely. There's just nobody around anymore. And so they don't have near the visitors. They're always checked and so on and so forth. But they're having some good communication there.
Why don't you tell us about the revelation and how it comes about, and at what point do we know this is where Joseph is pleading and the Lord speaks to him?
It's a marvelous letter. It's the March 20th, 1839 letter that Joseph addresses to the saints in Quincy, Bishop Partridge and Emma. And boy, it's 29 pages, man. Mm-hmm. And it's in the handwriting of Alexander McRae primarily. Also, Caleb Baldwin has a few pages. A few sentences, but boy, this is where Joseph, they postponed the trial again. So he's very hurt about that. And because, it's latter part of months. Now he knows
the prospects of being released
are diminishing here. And yet he knows they're supposed to have a trial and hopefully get released eventually. But he's hurt. He's just down.
Mm-hmm.
This has been a hard time emotionally for him, psychologically, and the saints have been suffering going over to Quincy.
And he's getting the reports on that and can't do anything about it.
Yeah, he's stuck there. So mm-hmm. You can see the heartfelt pleadings. And yet it's probably, in some ways, Joseph's finest hour
mm-hmm.
as he just unburdens his soul. In almost, I want to say, poetic expressions, anyone who reads sections 121, 122, you just sense a deep, a deepness and love and heartache of Joseph Smith for what's going on and for his love of the saints and the conditions they're in.
Why don't we continue talking about this revelation, this powerful, poignant pleading on the part of the prophet, but also the prophet's great response that he gets from the Lord. Let's talk about some of the great doctrines, the great teachings, those great messages that we have included in our Doctrine and Covenants that are just excerpts of those 29 pages. Why don't you just share with us some of those things that you find to be the most doctrinally profound from this revelation?
I think what's interesting is the Lord reassures Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
And, in spite of the difficulties, in spite of the hardships, you're going to be okay. And And you know the great phrase,
all these things shall give thee experience. But we also remember all the things previous to that that the Lord says that you may have to go through.
Yeah. But there is great purpose in suffering, and Joseph clearly understands that in a greater degree there. I think what's also reassuring is he tells him, you're definitely going to get out of here. Mm-hmm. And he says, thy days are known and shall not be numbered less. And I have to say, Brent, Lyman White said that Joseph Smith in Liberty Jail was assured that he'd have at least 5 more years.
Hmm.
And Joseph Smith comes out of Liberty Jail just totally confident. He knows God's with him,
mm-hmm.
and he'll back him up at least for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, what happens April 44, he knows my time's about up. So Joseph's very confident that God's still with him.
And he also, in that revelation, I think we also see not only did the Lord say that blessings would come from the suffering and all of that, but remember, he says he'll be exalted.
Yeah.
The Lord promises him eternal life. He basically seals him up in that prison temple. I think that's one of the reasons why he has the great confidence, is that he has indeed been with the Lord during this period of time and received that ultimate assurance.
Yeah. He's had a lot of time to think and a lot of time to contemplate the greatness of God and God's goodness and Joseph Smith's own purpose. And he's assured, again, I think you're very correct in your assessment that this can turn for a good thing.
What does the prophet Joseph learn there in Liberty about the saints, for the future of the saints? What does the Lord tell him about them?
He basically says, I've got a lot more to reveal. And Joseph Smith's, some of the greatest revelations, particularly I think we could say associated with temple and ceilings, the saints are going to be blessed with that. That's still got to come. We're not done with the revelations and with the restoration. It's not over. And that's why he says, men might as well try to stop the Missouri River with their puny arms as to hinder God from pouring out knowledge and power and authority upon the Latter-day Saints. So additional revelation, the restoration is not over.
Yeah, and I think that one of the great revelations there is especially in light of what they have been suffering. We use this scripture all the time about how we exercise priesthood and how we use our priesthood. And it's a great revelation there, but I think it's even more poignant and powerful when we realize what not only Joseph personally, but what the saints collectively have been suffering, and yet the Lord is saying to them, no priesthood, power. No power or influence is going to be used except upon these conditions. That really is perhaps antithetical to some of the things that they were feeling at the time. And the Lord is reminding them to be Christ-like in their use of the priesthood, because I'm sure they would have wanted to go and just clean the Missourians' clocks.
Yeah. And I have to think, Brent, too, that the Lord's speaking very personally to Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph had some rough edges.
Sure.
And he's saying, now, Joseph, you've got priesthood, but here's how it has to be channeled and governed. So it was like you say, a very good message to the saints, but even to Joseph Smith personally, we got to be very careful how we exercise that priesthood, that we don't, we're not compelling others, we're not, imposing and always show forth the increase of love if you've reproved, you see.
You know, there's that one beautiful passage there at the end of section 122 where he says, you're not yet like Job.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that was necessarily great comfort to Joseph at that moment, but I think it's so beautiful where he says, the Son of Man hath descended below them all. Art thou greater than he?
Yeah.
What a powerful, powerful message to say, Joseph, you haven't quite arrived at what I've suffered yet, and so I'm here to help you.
Yeah.
So.
And obviously no man can suffer like unto Christ, but he gave Joseph a good perspective there.
And what an interesting contrast as we wrap this up. Interestingly, Sidney Rigdon has a different reaction to his suffering in Liberty Jail than what the prophet Joseph did. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Sidney's perspective.
That is really interesting. In his hearing in 1844, following the martyrdom, Sidney's, of course, trying to claim some leadership role. And at his hearing, Brent, he actually said to Brigham and the 12, Jesus Christ was like a fool to me in suffering. In Sidney's mind, he felt like he had paid a price superior to that of Christ. I mean, it's almost unbelievable he could actually
say such things.
And yet Joseph takes it the other way and realizes, this was such a terrific thing that man must sometimes go through to become and know God. And Sidney's experience is completely opposite.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about how do they get out then, and as we close the chapter on the history of the church, how do we bring this all to a culmination, and how do we close the chapter on the Missouri period?
Well, eventually they did hold the hearing. It was up in Gallatin where the supposed crimes took place. And the judge up there was a man by the name of Birch. And Joseph's attorney, who at this time now is Stephen Peter Hardman Burnett, he issues a plea before the court that Birch can't hear the hearing because he prosecuted the case down in Richmond. So they asked for a change of venue or a change of location, and it was granted, and it was told that they would have it down in Boone County. That's center part of the state. And as far as we can tell, it looks like Birch and others were given the responsibility or told, let them go on this journey, let them take, send them on this change of venue. But apparently the guards who were called to take charge of Joseph and the others was told to let him go and make it look good. We really don't have anything on him. This is costing the state a lot of money to charge the Mormons and to keep this hearing going and so on. And as far as we can tell, the Missouri officials wanted to eventually let him go. The Mormons had made their way out of the state. They're gone. Let's let Joseph and them go. So on April 16th in Cheriton County, the guard said, it's time for you guys to get out of here. So
had they had any inkling that this was coming?
I think by that time they had. Yeah.
So they knew there was something up.
Yeah. And I think they're going, okay. And Joseph actually gives a promissory note and says, I'll pay you for the horse. And so they made their way over to Quincy and arrive on April 22nd. So it looks like, again, of course, the state's got to make it look like it's an escape. But clearly they don't really have anything on Joseph that they could probably prosecute him. So they had to kind of let him go.
But then if they kind of let him go and they don't have anything to prosecute him on, but yet when they get to Nauvoo, they spend an awful lot of time and energy trying to get him.
Well, what happens is we have a change of governors.
Okay.
And Thomas Reynolds is made the governor, and I don't think he knows of all the arrangements. And there's Joseph just across the river. Why don't you go after him? So they do try to extradite him. It doesn't prove successful. And the governor refused to sign the extradition order. So I think the chapter was pretty well finalized by that point. But I don't think Thomas Reynolds knew what was going on. Boggs would have been in there. There's no way he would have continued to pursue Joseph Smith.
Interesting. Well, in the Cliff Notes 1 minute version, Alex, of your years and years and years of studying Missouri, what would you say is the single greatest thing you take away, message you take away from your studies of the Missouri period of church history?
Wow, that's a loaded question.
Yep.
But, if people look back on Missouri, they'd say everything went wrong. But I'm sitting there going, not so much. Zion has not moved out of its place. Sure, external forces forced us out, but we learned a few things. And it refined the saints. And Joseph Smith did not come out of there. People didn't go, he's not a prophet. Most of the saints continued to be committed and become, I think, even a more resilient, vibrant, testimony-bearing people. We were purged in the fire of affliction. And I like President Hinckley's statement, in the whole history of our church, we've never taken a step backwards. In spite of the opposition, in spite of the conflict, we come through it. And as better and more faithful and more committed Latter-day Saints. And I think they were.
I think that's a great way to end this period of church history in our study on past impressions in the Mormon Channel. As we talk about the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Thank you, Professor Baugh. I'm Brent Topp, your host, inviting you to listen to future episodes of Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel.